Thank you, Diane. And you're listening to the John Carlos Sherry Ellicker Show with a combination news entertainment that Andrew has coined as
Newstame.
Here she comes.
Here comes Sherry. Oh. With the hot takes off.
It's the slower version.
She loves donuts and cupcakes. But you never know. Because 95 pounds is all she weighs. Yeah. Here comes Sherry with just two nipples now. Sherry. Oh. Here comes Sherry with the hot takes.
I
switched the lyrics in the first verse.
Yes,
but then I hadn't switched the lyrics in the chorus, so it goes right back into three nipples and all that stuff. So
Sherry,
I'll get in there. Don't worry.
People wrote in yesterday and said, "Why are you talking about her nipples?" So maybe we clarify that. I'm not sure.
You were bragging that you had three, and then you gave one away.
Okay, let's not use the word bragging. I admitted or confessed or whatever because somebody wrote in and said they had three nipples. I said, oh, so did I, but I got one. So I don't know if...
Oh, just your constant desire to want to relate to the audience.
Well, sure, because they may be three nipple-y's as well.
But what happened was John polled the audience. He said,
let's
hey.
Remember we have someone of somewhat stature and right. credibility wants to come
so,
on the show.
So just real quick, John polled the audience. He said, hey, we're writing an AI song for Sherry. Send us any information you think should be included. And three nipples, big hands, donuts, and cupcakes were what we got.
Right. So. Sorry, Sherry. All right, there we go. We straightened all that out. Diving in. Oh, no! Seattle Police Department, they've got themselves a contract. It's been approved. Retroactive raises. They've been working without a contract for a while, so now they've got this one is in place. And good for them. So they're going to get paid. They had to give up a few things, but all together. When I ask a friend of mine who's a cop, what do you think? He goes, it's good. We're happy with it. We think it's going to work. They said he doesn't think there's any problem with what they had to give up on it. Interesting sort of little side note, Sherry, is that now some of these cops that were waiting around can take the new money and then leave. There's 424 cops that are available at any time to be deployed, or there's 913 deployable officers, 425 cops are available for retirement, 280 are eligible. Could possibly retire. So I asked him, you think some people will just all of a sudden when the new contract kicks in, will then take that money because it moves into the retirement money and then leave? He says, possibly. A detective that works in traffic collision squad keeps a spreadsheet of officers and the age. The officer can retire at 50 years old with at least 20 years on and take a reduced pension. Officers 53 and older can retire with no penalty regardless of years on. So they're getting paid. They were working without a contract for 3 years, and now they've got retro. Plus, I think it works out to be about 3% cost of living every single year. So there you go.
The starting salary also has increased. It went from $83,000 to $103,000, which makes Seattle the highest paid police department in the state.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, they're below 1,000 officers. They hope to recruit more, but they don't know if people are going to leave because of this. They also made some changes to the way they do misconduct arbitrations, and they want civilians more involved in some of the process, the processes that go along with misconduct, and also just like police, kind of police duties.
I just think it's great. That's get a citizen that knows absolutely little or nothing about policing and put them on some sort of committee so that they can then judge the police behavior by their broad and deep understanding of the law and cops and how they do their jobs, he says cynically.
Yeah, these things are more like parking violations, I think. It's not really anything that's sort of police work, but it is. I think they think that there are citizens out there that are capable of doing these types of things that they don't have enough police officers to cover, and they will get paid.
Okay. Still, we're down. We don't have enough cops, and the cops that are out there most likely don't want to lose their job. So they'll just keep doing their job as the minimum amount of activity that they need to do. And if you'd like to make some money, you could file a tort suit against the chief, as a number of cops have that are female. Joining us is the attorney that is representing all four of these women. Let's see, Samir Singla, thank you for coming on. We talked about you the other day, and I thought, let's get that guy on the phone and find out if there's even more to it. So the story breaks that four women have stated that Chief Diaz engaged in predatory and discriminatory behavior. And there's also, you're roping in there, O'Neill is into this mix. You've seen the story break in the news. When you're sitting there listening to it or reading it, Shamir, what else do you notice that might be missing from the news of the four women that have brought these charges against the higher-ups there at SPD?
Yeah, hey, John, good afternoon, and thank you for having me on. It really kind of dovetails into what you're talking about with the contract and the officers leaving and this big recruitment push that the department has been doing. And my clients are part of the recruitment push. Three of my clients are the front-facing part of the department being used to recruit female officers. The department committed to this initiative called 30 by 30 last year, which their goal was to have the department be at least 30% women by 2030. And as part of that initiative, they instituted or asked for a study to see how women officers and female officers were feeling within the department. Now, there was a researcher who went out and interviewed a lot of female officers and was able to gather some of the data and information and publish it in a report that sat with the department since September of 23. If it wasn't for the media asking for that report, it would never have been released. It finally got released in February. And what the report essentially says is that the department has a culture of sexism and misogyny. And there were a lot of anonymous quotes from these female officers about how they've been treated throughout the years within the department. And one would expect that something was done about it, and there wasn't. And then my clients came along and decided to actually put a name to the face about some of the treatment they were having. What's been surprising to me is the treatment that these women have gotten since they actually became public with their complaints. Now, this is a department that came out and said, hey, look, we're trying to recruit more women. We're going to use my clients' videos, photographs, to have more women come on board. And when those same people that they're using to recruit are saying, hey, we're actually facing discrimination within, they are rallied with statements like, well, you know, this is a male-dominated environment, and we are sorry that you have this individualized perception of victimhood. So the question then becomes is, how are you going to get and fill more officers as officers are going to leave? Because, as you said, because of the contract, if the people that you're trying to use are actually saying, don't come work here.
So what was the motivator for them to come forward, the four of them?
It was the amount of pretty much abuse and retaliation that they suffered every time they got up and raised their head and said, hey, you know what, the way that they're being either treated by O'Neill or by the department in general is not right. And one of the things that started happening is the people that they were complaining about started weaponizing the complaint process, the process that you just got done talking about, right? So it was one of those, hey, I'm going to file a complaint because I feel like I'm being singled out and given assignments because I'm a woman. No other person has gotten the same assignments. And when I raise an issue about me getting these special assignments that nobody's gotten, and I make an EEO complaint, and then the person turns around and starts filing a series of complaints about insubordination. You know, at some point, you're just getting beat down. In the case of one of my clients, she's on the sergeant's list. She's passed the sergeant's exam. She's on the sergeant's list, but she hasn't even been given the position of acting sergeant. Now, you know, you'll get the department to say, we need more officers, we need more experienced officers, qualified officers. but she won't even get a chance to actually do what she's qualified to do.
Samir, as far as the sexual harassment claims or sexual harassment charges, what specifically are the women claiming happened to them?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting is these women, three of these women are fairly new to the department. They're 5 years or younger to the department. And some of the male officers kind of take it upon themselves to develop this mentoring relationship. It's not a formal mentorship program. They're just basically saying, hey, look, stick with me and I'll show you the ropes of how to get ahead of the department. And when you were a young junior officer and a superior officer or a supervisor comes to you and say, hey, I'm going to tell you, so stick with me and let you go. It's really, or, you know, so that you can get ahead in the department. It's really hard for them to say no, right?
Yeah.
And then they develop this trust relationship with them under the guise of mentoring, and then from that they exploit the relationship for some pretty concerning behavior, taking one officer to Las Vegas and making some pretty crude remarks during a dinner to that officer, demanding another officer make herself available so the superior officer can go and inspect her home so a canine dog can live there. And when they rebuff those and kind of are saying, hey, you know what, this relationship is not going the way it is, it turns around and all of a sudden these young officers are becoming the problem child of the department and are getting complaints against them.
Now, I don't know if you care to, and I won't say the name, but we know that there is another case that is in appeals of the same example, but this is a male officer that noticed that any advancement at the SPD was being blocked continuously because of some things that he had brought to their attention. So this might seem to be a pattern of, you know, you go along with us and we'll move you along, but if you don't go along with us, then we're going to stop you from advancing in your career. And it looks like for the four women, they have enough evidence that you could see, well, you know, I was playing along, doing what I was supposed to do, and then I noticed that I wasn't moving forward or was being blocked or at least not promoted. You have enough evidence, and I guess as you file for discovery on this, you'll start to see some of this hopefully become evident as to whether, you know, this has actually occurred or not. But for each one of these women to come forward, they really are basically just throwing themselves out there at the mercy of the court and of the legal system because this is a career wrecker for them.
Right. And thanks for mentioning the other case. And I know you had a chance to cover that as well. And, you know, that case really was in a lot of ways, I'll just call it as a canary in the coal mine for at least my team to recognize the pattern of the dysfunctional behavior within the department. And that case went on for about 3 years. We were able to take it to trial. We were successful in front of a jury on obtaining a really successful result for my client. On a hostile work environment. And the facts in that case, like you mentioned, are pretty egregious, that his career was pretty much, it came to a complete halt. The facts in these cases with these women has also a layer of gender discrimination, which wasn't present in the other case.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're right, it starts to develop a pattern. And if you'll recognize, and if you could do the research, at least two of these officers were in the public affairs unit. So they were the ones who were talking to you folks in the press and talking to the public about how great the department was. And that's a pretty sought after unit. But once they started to say, you know what, we're not feeling comfortable with the way that some of our superiors are treating us and then this relationship, all of a sudden they're booted out of the unit and they're sent to, you know, do great work. And they love doing the work that they're doing, but they're not doing the work that they were excited about doing in the public affairs unit. And I'll just finish with this. The reason that one of the reasons that my clients came forward is they have nothing to lose, right? They're getting broken. So they need to speak out so the department can take some action.
Can you talk to about the fact that the HR manager, who is a woman, is implicated in this?
She is, indeed. And there is, going back to what John said, there is this pattern that has developed when we started talking to our clients individually, and the same name kept coming up as running interference within the complaints that were being filed. and then them not going anywhere. And that was this HR manager who would then pick up the equal employment opportunity complaint and then have this kind of roundtable discussion and try to brush it under the rug, saying, it seems like it's a supervisor problem, or you just have a personality problem. Or in one case, and this is the most egregious case, she instructed one of the young female officers to treat her superior as a piece of meat, and she needed to pretend like she was a puppy dog, and she needed to do everything to get that piece of meat.
Golly. Now, the fact that this is so high up, so Diaz is the chief. He is mentioned in this. He is part of this suit. There's the story. Is it true that Diaz said to one of the officers, I'll come to your house and help repair some things at your house, or I can come over tonight and take a look at, you know, if you need some maintenance work done or something like that? And to me, that is, as they would say, shocks the conscience of the court that the chief would be fraternizing or at least offering that type of service. It's uncomfortable for the officer, obviously, because this is the boss coming in on this sort of thing. Is that part of the complaint against Diaz?
It is, indeed. He, to one of the, again, young female officers, they were having a conversation about how things were going, and my client had just recently purchased a house, and she was talking about the cost of repairs and needed to repair windows, and Chief, lo and behold, comes and says, hey, you know, I'll just come to your house and repair your windows. And this is piggybacking on other media reports of the chief offering to do similar type of home repair work for other female employees. You know, again, which then we're talking about, and I'll stick to the term that you use, John, is we're talking about developing this pattern of behavior within the department that is really problematic. And I live in this city. I'm a citizen of the city of Seattle. These are my taxpayer dollars. I live in this city. And when the police chief is in a public forum and neighbors and business owners are complaining about crime, and his excuse is, we don't have enough officers. We're trying to hire more officers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the way you're running your department is the reason you don't have enough officers. So we need to fix that.
Yeah. Well, listen, I give these four women credit. I'm sure Sherry does as well, because it must be very hard to do this and come forward and now take the public slings and arrows that follow with something like this. But Samir Singla, thank you very much for coming on. The attorney for the four officers charging sexual harassment against Mr. O'Neill and Chief Diaz as well. Thank you, Samir. Appreciate it. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, guys. Have a good day.
You too. Let's see. You remember when after Trump left, I think one of the guys, who was the official fact checker? Was he working at, was he at CNN or something? I think he left. Or maybe the New York Times, the Washington Post. My Washington Post fact checkers. Okay, yep, we don't need to fact check anymore. So Biden gets in there with all his stuff. And now, I don't know why they did this. White House officially claims Biden has made 148 mistakes. At least they use the word mistakes, right? Misspoken is the other word that they use sometimes. During 2024 public remarks. So it was, people would see the transcript. Like, did they put in there when he would say some sort of word, they put in inaudible. And then other words, they would slip in there and then they notice. So people are watching what words they put in place. So there are 148 mistakes made by the President of the United States. And is this news to anybody? Sherry?
I don't think it's news, but if you want it broken down, I can tell you the total flubbed names and titles of individual.
Oof. And listen, I'm very sympathetic. Okay. Flubbed names is kind of my middle name.
20 times since the beginning of the year.
Okay.
Misrepresented the number of his accomplishments and confused the difference between 1,000, million, billions, and trillions. That was 12 times.
Hey, you do that a lot, too.
I do. I like that.
Yeah, all right. He also confused pronouns. Instead of saying he'd say we. That was 13 times. Healthcare is the big one. That was, just different things. Like, for instance, he called it Roe versus Ward. And he confused...
Who could ever forget that case?
disabilities. With diabetes.
Disability, so give him, he's half right.
Okay, and that happened about 20 times since the beginning of the year.
Yeah. The thing is that the weird stuff is, I said this before, here he is with this weird... Listen, the only thing that saved him on this one is the people that were cheering were not yelling, four more years, pause. Four more years, pause. Here he's...
Folks, imagine what we can do next. Four more years, pause.
Four more years, pause. Four more years.
He said pause twice. It's in the teleprompter. It says four more years. And then you're supposed to pause to allow the people to say four more years. But they didn't yell out, four more years, pause, four more years,
well,
pause.
They also didn't jump in fast enough, so he didn't quite know what to do. So he thought maybe if he says the word pause, that would get them, you know, motivated or something.
No, what was that? Was it Jeb Bush? Please clap. Remember that when he made some joke or something like that? And then he went, please clap. And applause lines and things like that. Yeah, listen, it's not a secret to anybody, but the media has basically kind of, they don't promote all of this. But you know, remember when Trump accidentally or, you know, misspoke and said Thailand instead of Thailand? And then it was like pages and
that
pages.
That is funny.
Wait, why is that funny? Why is Thailand funny? Thailand funny.
Thailand is... That's a funny word.
Okay.
Hey, I'm heading to Thailand this summer.
I've always been kind of a butt guy, but I'm going to head over to Thailand, see what's going on over there. And my favorite is this. And I get it. You're supposed to relate to the audience in some sort of way, like you trying to relate to people because you had three nipples and you were hoping to get the three nipple audience. I got that, Sherry, what you were doing. You know, that's just common, right?
Sure.
But my favorite is this one. No matter what group he's in front of, like if he's in front of a bunch of cannibals, he's like, I hope you guys enjoyed eating my uncle, right? If he was talking to a bunch of cannibals. But in this case, it's like every single category, whatever group he's in front of, somehow he's able to, like, relate to them in a very personal way.
I was sort of raised in the Puerto Rican community.
Puerto Rican community, raised in the Puerto Rican. There's some Puerto Rican. This is in Pennsylvania. Here we go.
I had a very close relationship with the Greek American community. Greek. For real. I am Joe Bidenopoulos. I grew up in a heavily Irish Catholic community.
The Irish and the Puerto Ricans and the Greeks were all in there.
And Pennsylvania, and heavily. Italian Polish community.
Oh, Italian Polish community. I think he was raised in the back room where they keep the brooms at the United Nations.
When I say I got raised in the black church, he knows I'm not kidding.
The Persian culture.
Now Persian culture. At this point, he's like, it's Persian, Iranian, Persian culture. Like what's okay? He's thinking like Persians with rugs. Guys wear a lot of cologne. Food is like it's pretty spicy. Like, Persian culture? We're gonna do Persian culture. Like,
my kid, the Persian culture is
men are hairy, so are the women. I got hair on my back. What's he gonna do?
Amazing. As a student of the Persian culture,
that's always a good out.
I come out of the black community. The background of my family is Irish American, not fundamentally unlike the Palestinian people.
I might say raised in the synagogue in my state.
Everybody in town was either Polish or Italian. I grew up feeling self-conscious. My name didn't end in an SKI.
I was raised in a neighborhood where I felt self-conscious, my name didn't end in O.
That's kind of how I was raised, like so many Americans of Irish heritage.
In HBCU, in your home state, Mr. President.
Let me tell you, forget about it. That's where I got raised, man.
Just like rabbis, synagogues, and Jewish community centers in your hometown, and that's the tradition I got raised. Hard-working people.
He was raised in a synagogue in a black church. Right. Oh, wait, let's see. The last place he's going to go.
Middle class, the neighborhoods I got raised in.
I was raised on GM.
I was raised by Danny Noah.
I was raised by a righteous Christian.
I got raised on automobiles.
Raised by automobiles. Okay.
Got a lot of parents in there. And he spent a lot of time in religious buildings. Boy.
Very
pious. Please clap.
Where did he find
Please
the
clap.
Time?
Yeah, Jeb Bush.
Please clap.
Please clap. Yeah. Oh, my God. As I've said before, the guy's been in this since he was 28 years old, right? He's, what, 81 now. So you could get away with that at a Rotary Club speech or a breakfast as a senator's going to speak. But then people weren't fact-checking. They couldn't check any of this sort of stuff. See, wherever you show up, you just show up and you always try to relate to everybody. But now it's all the tape and people go, wait a minute. How often is he, who was he raised by? You know, I got arrested and I marched with Nelson Mandela and I got arrested with Nelson Mandela. And it's like, oh, come on. But it doesn't matter because that's the guy that they want to be in there. Although now the recent polls, really, the CNN poll that came out yesterday, oh, devastating for the White House. They're mad at the New York Times for not kind of carrying the water for them. And the New York Times is now mad at the White House for not making him available. So there's a bunch of backbiting that's going on. I think they realize Biden ship is slowly sinking. That's why James Carville, who you remember in 1992, his famous thing was, it's the economy, stupid. So now he's got something new, the Raging Cajun. Here is his new thing. Because remember, it was a couple months ago, he said, you know, you got to get rid of the stuff, the crazy stuff on the left. So here's his new advice.
Young voters are just not into this. It's two candidates. One's in the 80s. One's almost in the 80s. And they're concerned about things that Washington are politicians. And you just can't blame them for, oh, you. All right. Are you watching what is happening in the Supreme Court? If you're 26, do you see what they're doing? First of all, they're going to take every right that you could possibly have away from you. So my advice to tell these young people to get off your motherfucking ass and go vote because you should vote like your entire future and the entire future of this United States depends on it, because quite frankly, it does.
Uh-oh.
And that's not an exaggeration.
Okay, so it's the economy, stupid. Now it's blank you. It's a new motto.
Yeah, and in the beginning there, I thought he was channeling Bill Cosby.
Someone named it with the jello pudding.
Young James Young.
I like the jello pudding. Okay. I like the jello pudding. The jello pudding. Come on, everybody, up on the dance floor. How about the bride and her father? Here we go. Been to one of those, Sherry, where they choreograph the wedding dances? Oh.
Yeah, and, you know, they start off dancing really slow to some song, and then all of a sudden they break into another thing, and they choreograph the whole dance.
Yeah, and then you scream, stop this absurdity.
I actually do think it's kind of cool.
Oh.
Because anytime anybody can get together and figure out something choreographed is sort of an amazing feat.
Which is this show right here, Sherry. Mm-hmm. The cheese ball man finally gets his crowd. He draws a massive amount of onlookers to watch him eat an entire jumbo jar.
Yep.
What's the jumbo jar? Is that the family size fun pack or whatever it is?
It's like a Costco size. There are probably 1,000 of them in there.
And it's a little like, it's not cheese. It's a little like a
cheese ball.
Little cheese ball.
Yeah,
little cheese ball.
Everybody
have water!
Because he had advertised this, right, Sherry, on something, social media, that he's going to go there to Times Square and eat a whole bunch of them, or Union Square, and then people are going to watch him.
Yeah, he put up posters weeks before to try to get people interested. And when the event finally showed up, or when it started, hundreds of people showed up. I mean, if you listen to the crowd, I mean, they with nothing left to do in New York City on that particular day, they showed up for Cheese Ball Man.
Well, he whipped them into a frothing frenzy.
Sure.
The cheese ball man has finished the last cheese ball, and the crowd goes wild. 2,641 calories consumed, and now they're calling for cheese ball man.
Yeah, I'm gonna throw up. Definitely, yeah.
Can I shake your hand?
No.
Can I shake your hand? Can I shake your cheese hand?
Are you sure?
Please.
Will you run for president?
Yes.
Yes. I'm only 22, but when I can, yeah.
Cheese ball man now being nominated to be president of the United States.
Cheese ball man.
Contest on the horizon.
No, I don't do food contests.
cheering the fact that he's non-competitive and but not engaging. You know, I mean, people were walking around and the guy's going to eat a big thing of cheese ball, so I'd stay and watch, wouldn't you?
No, people came for cheese ball, man.
Okay, Joe, but there were people who had to be walking by.
Yeah, a few.
Sherry, would you stop and watch cheese ball, man? How much cheese ball?
You know, I think it's one of those eating contests kind of make me nervous. Like, I'm always worried the person is going to get sick or throw up. It's like the hot dog eating contest. I can't watch that. I mean, cheese balls are a little less offensive, but a lot of people said this was life-changing for them. One guy said it was the hero we needed in these troubled times. Somebody else said it was just hilarious. And I'm so worried they're going to choke or something's going to happen to them when they're shoveling the food in.
Because you're also uncomfortable because you know he could probably use some water or something else to help him. So each ball, each cheese ball that he's consuming, you feel like you're eating it right there with him.
Yeah, and there's so many in that big tub.
So many.
But this is, I guarantee you, more people were there to watch Cheeseball Man that are at the UW encampment at the Quad right now.
Yes.
Like, this is like normal people stuff. The media wants you to think everybody's protesting or rioting. They're watching Cheeseball Man.
Like in 19, there's a guy who was Harvard. He might have been a freshman at Harvard, and he ate a goldfish. And this is when it was, you know, no social media, obviously. And then it became this big fad to eat goldfish, to swallow goldfish. And it was like people were doing it all over the United States. There was flagpole sitting was a big thing for a while there. And then this guy swallowed a goldfish. And then everybody else is swallowing goldfish. Are you all right with that, Sherry?
Well, you feel a little bad for the fish. I mean, you know, because you don't want it to die. But
they don't die. They enjoy the swim. It's mostly downstream.
Mostly downstream, full of a lot of acid. So I don't think they survive very long. Why would you? You would swallow like a ocean of goldfish.
If I had to, for something like that, yeah.
Don't swallow a slug.
I ate the spleen of a snake. Well, that was an interesting experience. The guy had a whole bunch of it, and you pull out the snake, and then he cuts the snake's the spleen or whatever. Gallbladder is a bladder. A snake can live without a bladder.
Which was it? The gallbladder?
It was a bladder, okay?
Big difference.
It's not a big difference. It was a bladder.
Joe Curley.
No, there's a difference between... I don't think snakes have gallbladders.
Okay, you know what? All right, you know what? I'm going to get cheese balls stick it in your ears.